call today, Yeonbin, the chair, Philip Shepherd, who is Task Force Working Group chair, Lynn Gudendorf, Christopher Gibson, Melanie Holloway, Maria Farrell, and myself as staff, Glenda Saint-Gervais.
Thank you. Yes, there has been made available a further note. I am afraid it was made available rather late, but hope that you have had the possibility to have a look at it. And I'd like to thank those who contributed to towards developing the option two, which you'll find in the paper. Let's start just by taking a general glance at the paper. It consists of three parts. One is the statement of the distinction between natural and legal persons. The second is the issue on commercial and non-commercial activities, the distinction between those. And the third is the note on declarations in bad faith. And as far as I understand, there is a large, perhaps total consensus about the first part, a natural and legal person. And perhaps we could start by making sure that there is nothing we have overlooked in that respect.
I'd like to put my name in the queue. This is Chris Gibson.
Please go on, Chris.
Yes, good morning. I think that it would be worthwhile. I have just opened up and started to review your helpful summary paper. Thank you for circulating that. I think it would be helpful to add just before your reference to commercial or non-commercial activities, this is on the first page,
yep,
that there were at least some members of the working group that raised whether some form of verification could be made as to this first distinction. And I understand the approach in the paper is to consider whether consensus was raised, but I believe at least there are a few of us who have suggested that while we haven't, as I understand it, come to any agreement or any fleshed out approach on what verification could include, well, we thought it would be helpful, at least in respect of natural versus legal persons, that a verification approach of this would be made. So simply a sentence to reflect that there were some members of this working group that had raised that as a possibility, I think would reflect the discussions. I know last call we focused on commercial versus non-commercial,
but you're quite right. I think also the information has been floated that some registrars today already have procedures for verification in this respect. So a note certainly should reflect at least that one do not suggest such verification to be stopped. And so that, as you say, either at the end of the first section or about where it may say that it is based on self-declaration, a note will be made that this is an issue.
My other point on that same point is this, which is, I know because last week we had, I thought, a very helpful discussion on commercial versus non-commercial, and we went into it in some detail. I was hoping to actually return to the question during this call of self-declaration versus verification and perhaps to get some input from some of the registrars on how that works, because I felt like we hadn't yet finished off that issue. But anyway, thank you very much for your acknowledgement.
John, Philip here. Just also a thought on clarifying option one. It might be worth making explicit what I understand is has been an implication of making the distinction between natural and legal, in that the sort of a partial regime that we had laid out in the matrix under commercial and non-commercial would then be the implication of that distinction, i.e. that there would be full disclosure for legal,
yep,
and retained disclosure for natural persons. I think it's probably just worth
indeed, yes,
putting that explicitly to clarify that's the intent in terms of why the distinction is being made.
Indeed, and that should be made. Indeed, yes, it is mentioned under option two, but not under option one, and I make sure that is edited in a way which makes it clear that it applies to both options.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. There might actually be the verifications of the declaration might actually be displayed as an option under a national legal person, which is not resolved, but which the attention is drawn to. And as I see it, our main purpose is to make the options clear. Because there will be a procedure following this discussion, which will make the final choices between the options, and it would be, I guess, not appropriate to close options which might be opened at a later stage, mm-hmm. but rather to clarify them so that the choices are as easy to make as possible.
Yes, I think Philippa, again, I think John, that would be helpful, because. I mean, essentially what we're saying is if we're not recommending a mandatory form of verification for either option, the implication, again, is that there could be a challenge process to the self-declaration, mm. which indeed then falls into the responsibilities of the OPOC, which is being fleshed out in another group. So it's merely just one additional responsibility the OPOC would have in terms of a challenge over false information, alleged false information.
Indeed.
This is Chris again, and just to to highlight the contrast on this point of self-declaration, I think for option two, a self-declaration is more appropriate, is much more appropriate in that context, and so. In that sense, you know, when you have a natural person who decides to register a name, it would have to be, I would think, in most cases, it would be very hard to verify if they don't have any track record what they intend to do with it. So a self-declaration for option two is actually a very different setting than the question of whether self-declaration for option one. So that's why using that word carefully, I think it has to be highlighted in each context what the discussion has been.
Yes, that's right. Especially as on the time of the registration, you will be declaring your future intentions, and that is extremely difficult to verify. While whether you are a legal or natural person, of course, is something that is verifiable in principle.
Yes, exactly. One is a past fact, and the other is a future intent.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, it's Maria. Can I just recap? The idea there was to present then two options, self-declaration of commercial versus non-commercial as well, was that it?
No, we'll be keeping it only one option for the self, only keeping self-declaration for the distinction between commercial and non-commercial, right?
Oh, right, apologies, thank you.
That makes sense.
And as I see it right now, it's already highlighted as the distinction in the area of commercial versus non-commercial on page two. You already have that this distinction should be made on the basis of self-declaration, et cetera. So you've touched on it there.
Perhaps it could be emphasized a bit. It's better, but it is touched there, yes. Also, I see, I'm very grateful for those of you who have been working on the itemized list of how the distinction between commercial and non-commercial activities should be made. I think perhaps that the most important thing is that there is such a list showing that you are able to get to a level beyond or below the distinction between commercial and non-commercial, that you can pick out some more concrete criteria. And then, of course, there may be a discussion or even a struggle over which criteria to put there. But that is secondary to the first one, that it is possible to put such criteria there if one would like, and that, of course, opinions are divided on that.
John, if we're moving to that list, can I make one or two quick comments? I don't know if we're at that point.
They don't really have to be quick.
Oh, okay. First, I think there's a typo under what is the itemized A, the very first one. It says the offer, and then the word for, I think, should be changed to or. It's the offer or sale of goods or services, and that's just a typographical. And secondly, I wanted to state something that, you know, having worked on this, wanted to make sure at least one vision that I had of how this could work, and it sort of builds out of my work in the early days when I was working on the first draft of the UDRP, and we came to work together with the registrar group at the very end of that phase, and we realized that the language we use has to be very user-friendly. And so you could imagine that something like this list of criteria could be worked on with fleshed-out examples such that if someone's on a website trying to register a domain name, and that person is a natural person, they have this list, and it says, here are examples. You can put it in language that is relatively simple. Here are examples of commercial activities. They could read the list, and if we assume that person is a person in good faith, they can try to make a decision based on their future intentions of whether they fit into a commercial versus non-commercial category. And so you can see this list could be the basis, with some further work on drafting in the future, for a more user-friendly list, perhaps with examples of things that might be considered commercial activities. I just wanted to give you that background view. And just one other comment more generally on the paper. Some of what you've touched on in your paper is referenced only to the European Data Protection Directive. And I believe to make this a stronger summary, it would be helpful perhaps to consider referring also to the non-binding APEC privacy framework, and I know that Lynn was able to find that, and I think she could forward a copy of that in PDF form, or perhaps also to U.S. law, because when you think about what percentage of the globe you're talking about, it seems in this international context that only referring to the EU Data Protection Directive sort of brings this out of kilter with other parts of the world where we're supposed to be taking a very international approach.
Yes, that is... At least formally, it is a very valid comment. On the other hand, the European Data Protection Directive is the only binding legal instrument for a region. All the others are non-binding, and they are international ones are non-binding, and it is the only one that is enforced for a region. So all the others will be for jurisdictions, but of course the United States is a large jurisdiction, and if it had been a very appropriate legal instrument, that would be certainly a candidate to refer to. But I'm at a loss to find what to use under the U.S. Jurisdiction as a reference.
Yeah, I understand. And certainly with all of the legislation that's happening and drafts before the U.S. Congress on various issues of related to the broader privacy issue, but...
But I would say that for North America, the Canadian PIPEDA, could be... at least something from North America, and it has a schedule, of 10 fair information principles that, could be useful, at least in our thinking. And I think coming back to the Asia-Pac Economic Council privacy framework, even though it's non-binding, it still has some value in us thinking about people in other parts of the world regard privacy.
Yes, certainly. As you know, in my first note, I made reference both to the APEC and the OECD guidelines, which are the two international sets of regulations which are widely referred to. I was hesitant, actually, to dive into the data protection thing because I seem to be so familiar with that I may overemphasize it. But on the request, I certainly will do the APAC and perhaps the OECD, and I'll look at there's a federal Canadian data protection and freedom.
So this is Chris. I know you're trying to keep this note short, and the goal would be to say you could probably, in the way you raise them, mention one's binding, the other one isn't. I mean, the broader backdrop for all of us is we know that there's been a discussion over time that, for example, sometimes the EU approach on certain issues sets the most, if it's a mandatory approach because it's a regulation or directive transposed into national law, then what you have is essentially a region of the world that somehow as a de facto threshold sets pushes pressure on other parts of the world. And that's something I think that we have to be, and we are being sensitive of in this context, but here I think quite appropriately, you have to touch on some other sources in an international context here if you're going to get into any of this type of referring to law.
It's Maria here. I've got a question. We have, in the long process that we have been dealing with WHOIS, have referenced and name-checked many, many different national and international legal instruments regarding privacy, binding and non-binding. My question to this group would be, what is it specifically about APEC, OECD, et cetera, that is relevant to this question that we were trying to address in this paper? And if people want to have references to those instruments in, can they come up with the specific insights that those legal instruments give us on the issue at hand, which is the distinctions, the two distinctions that we're discussing here? Because it's not going to be terribly useful to just simply name check things. What we really need to do is pull out of those instruments what are the insights that are going to help us try and at least elucidate, if not resolve, these issues.
I thought that what we were going to do was to say that a legal person is not protected under the majority of data protection instruments, and then reference not only the European Data Protection Directive, Article 2A, but also APEC and perhaps OECD and the Canadian legislation for exactly that issue with a detailed reference.
Yeah, this is Chris. I could at least say in having reviewed a few days ago the APEC that the two points that I found that interesting are there. The first one, what John suggested, that the distinction between legal and natural persons in APEC is also reflected. And secondly, there's some language in there that talks about the processing of personal data, which is quite similar to the EU data protection. And it's from that language that both the EU and the APEC that we were able to, for example, develop what is itemized as E on our little list there, information in relation to the collection, storing, and processing of personal data.
That's very helpful. Well, then could we, is Lynn going to send the APEC guidelines around to the list? That would be helpful if one of you might be able to do that, and just to draw people's attention to the relevant provisions in them. And if we're going to be mentioning other things like PIPEDA, et cetera, then we would really need to have those things circulated as well. And again, attention drawn to the relevant section.
Yes, I attempted to send the APEC. It's in an Adobe file, and it was too large to work in our email list. Is there another way that I can distribute it?
Yeah, if you could circulate the URL where the PDF could be found.
I actually didn't have it from a URL.
Okay. I mean, the alternative there would simply be extracting from it the relevant clause, because I mean, all we're looking at here is really a linkage between us saying legal persons full disclosure, natural persons retain disclosure, and the link is natural persons have protection under these sorts of laws.
Yeah, I think that's helpful, Philip. I can, for example, in the scope, which is part two under commentary, one of the first sentences, it says this: the framework is intended to apply to information about natural living persons, comma, not legal persons. I mean, it's that kind of statement that is quite helpful in seeing how they approach this from a big picture.
Exactly, sir.
Actually, what I think this is what you know is citing is the consensus emerging from perhaps not all, because that is such a large word. But at least from the legal instruments that I'm aware of, and I've done a bit of comparative work on exactly this basic concept. So I think I can say that with some at least more than superficial glance through the both national legislation and mm-hmm. international.
So just to jump in, this is Ross. I joined about 10 minutes ago. Everyone, good morning.
Hello. Okay.
So I'm working the references to which you are indicating. I think I have them available, so that shouldn't be too difficult. But it will be not, as I see it, a substantial amendment, but just bolstering up so it is not so European-centered. And I do appreciate the comments about the tension that occasionally is perceived between the European policy and the policies of some other parts of the world. So if that could sum up our discussion of option two, is there anything else you'd like to add to what is discussed under option two? then I understand that you seem to agree that there should be a challenge process if you look at the declaration in bad faith part.
Yes, I think so. I mean, for me, that naturally comes as a consequence, particularly of a process of self-declaration, I think.
Yeah. But we haven't discussed. We have left that as a presumption. So we haven't discussed the how it should be made, the procedures decided, or the consequences of it found to be bad faith.
This is Chris. I'm just wondering whether we call it bad faith, or I see your label there, and or whether we just. If there's another more neutral role, I know bad faith draws on language that's used in other contexts that are relevant to domain names. Let me give you an example. Someone registers as a natural person involved in non-commercial activity, and they simply tick a box to indicate at the time they register that's their intention. And then, 3-4 years later, they're using their website in a very commercial way, not in one of these closed cases that we've discussed on our calls. There I would suggest that, it may be, if the type of system that I believe has been envisaged by Philip and others is that an after-the-fact sort of self-policing mechanism, there may be a third party out there in the world who would want to challenge that through a lightweight procedure, then it's a matter of they need to, they may want to challenge that this shouldn't be properly classified as that type of a registration. So I would say that, you could just call it challenge procedure I just see that as one small distinction that might be worth it. And then secondly, the question on in general on this document is whether you would want any proposed small changes to language throughout.
I'm very aware that I'm writing a language that's not my own. You should see my Norwegian. but I would be very grateful for editorial amendments to improve the language. I know the quality of my English, I'm afraid.
Just going back to the question there of
bad faith,
of bad faith and the challenge mechanism. I mean, to some extent, there is already an existing mechanism, isn't there, which is the accuracy policy, which is in place, and the reminder you get from your registrar to confirm that the WHOIS data is accurate. So that to some extent mitigates, and that's every year. So that to some extent mitigates the change of use thing that Chris was hinting at. I think in terms of language. I mean, perhaps it's also declaration in bad faith, omission, where it's basically. A mistake in good faith rather than an intentional bad faith, but that's just a detail. I think the mechanism is going to be identical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. To the extent this becomes a piece of data that is collected at the time of registration, it becomes part of the data that is supposed to be submitted accurately.
Yeah.
John, it's Maria. I'm just, coming back to page one of this document. The first sentence of the section, second sentence of the section, which is called commercial or non-commercial activities, it says there is a consensus to the extent that it would be appropriate to have such a distinction. I am not sure there is a consensus in this group that it would be, because I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Avery Doria did not agree that we should be making this type of distinction.
Sorry, yeah, that's good for you to point out, because that's exactly that. There's two possible ways of seeing this, and I thought perhaps there was an agreement that if it could be made operational, the distinction was
okay.
Would be valuable.
Yeah, I certainly don't agree with that.
Hmm?
You don't agree with that?
No, with the distinction. I think the analysis is sound, John. Sorry.
That's
but with the, I don't think it's a worthwhile distinction to be making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Okay. Well, then maybe Maria, in terms of language, there we should be using this. I can't remember what the exact words are now. It was support agreement or minority report or something. See, those three categories of wording that we're going to be using for gauging levels of support later may be just useful to use that language to clarify and not use the consensus word.
I'll do that.
Thank you, Maria. I'll consult with you on that.
Right. Thank you for bringing that up. I had thought myself to bring it up because I was aware of the fact that I had presumed something there that I hadn't confirmed. All right. Is there anything else you'd like to make? If not, I suggest that this on this basis we prepare a final draft of this small paper. It is one step ahead. The next level up will take on the options and take action on the basis of the options that we hopefully have clarified for them. So I do not propose this call next week.
But do you think it would be, this is Chris, do you think it would be useful then to have one more call to have an opportunity to comment on the next draft? I know it's for some of us early in the morning, but I just find that it's a lot more, sometimes the call is a lot quicker than, you know, having, you know, the various emails that, you know, relentlessly come in on anything that's posted.
I know that I won't be available on the next Wednesday at this time.
Okay. But, I mean, John, it may be sufficient because, I mean, essentially we're not changing the content of the report. We may just be suggesting the odd editorial clarification or intent or whatever. I'd have thought that could probably be done happily by email. And again, I just remind everybody that the remit of the subgroups is merely to discuss and then list options. It's not required to make value judgments about those options. That comes in next stage.
Indeed, yes. And I certainly is open for any suggestions you may have and will have, and I'll try to take them into consideration for the next draft. I'll start this weekend traveling. I will be traveling for 1 month at various places, but I'll be tugging along my portable, so I probably will be on the available most of the time.
Oh. But again, I mean, John, if you're unable to do that, then I'm sure Maria can put the final touches just in terms of you know, clarifying words to report the language to the main group. Yeah.
Yeah, I rely upon her to do that and also to have a look at the language.
Okay, sure.
Okay. This is Chris. I wanted to ask sort of one other question, and I know that I believe Bertrand has been on this call before and also in some of the other subgroups. And he had a general sort of, as I may be misstating his position, but I think he sort of had a lack of understanding of what was the intended consequence of this distinction and what was the scope of application of the OPAC. And, you know, as I see it, and the basis upon which I put in a proposal last week, and the way I read this document now, particularly page 2, with the four boxes, the idea would be that perhaps based on some of the distinctions this group has discussed, there'd be a full disclosure of who is data, and linked to that, then the idea would be that perhaps an OPAC approach, if some type of approach is implemented, would only be retained for one of the boxes, non-commercial activities by natural persons, for example. As an alternative, I just wondered if the, you know, if that was, I saw, for example, Maria had a definition of open versus closed in one of the earlier drafts, and that's the basis upon which I've understood the discussions in this group.
Philippe, I think that's correct, but of course we're only looking at distinctions that can be made and therefore implications for the data that's displayed. the other side of the coin in terms of OPOC is all to do with responsibilities of
yes.
the
yes.
point of contact.
Yeah.
So I think that's, you know, as long as we're aware of just that one slice of the thing that we're looking at and making listing options about.
I think I took care. I took into consideration yours and Bertrand's remarks in trying to make it at least a bit more clear what the consequences of the distinction would be. Right. Any more comments, anyone? It is a very bright and sunny day here, north of Oslo. But I look forward to going out into the sunshine again.
thank you all for coming in, and I'm looking forward to your contributions, and we'll prepare a final version of this talk.
One last thing. I think coming out of sort of a to-do item on this list, I think perhaps Lynn and I can try to send in some information or some quotes from the APEC privacy framework.
Yeah, please do. Though I'd also, without your prompt, look at the APEC. But I'd be grateful for any references or citations.
Yes, I'd be happy to work with you, Chris, on that.
It was very helpful, the work you did prior to this meeting, as it and I hope you see reflected in the note. Thank you.
Hello, John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
And then I'm alone.